For 3 whole days I remained in that room pleading indisposition while I practiced how to make the body do what I wanted it to do, and trying to contain myself because this was truly the most frightening experience I had had in my life. I had put up with all manner of torments in China and in Tibet and in Japan, but this was a new and utterly revolting experience. The experience of being imprisoned in the body of another person and having to control it. I thought of that which I had been taught so many years ago that indeed it seemed to be a different life. Lobsang, I had been told, in the days of long ago the great beings from far beyond this system and beings who were not in human form, had to visit this earth for special purposes. Now, if they came in their own guise they would attract too much attention, so always they had bodies ready which they could enter and control, and appear to be the natives of the place. In the days to come, I was told, you will have such an experience, and you will find it to be utterly shocking. I did. For the benefit of those who are genuinely interested, let me say a few things about transmigration, because really I have so much to tell the world, and yet because of the vilification of the press people have been hoaxed into believing my story. I will tell you more about that in the next book, but one of the things I was going to do was to show people how transmigration worked, because there are so many advantages to it. Think of this, which I am going to put to you as a definite possibility. Mankind has sent a messenger to the moon, but mankind does not know how to travel in deep space. In relation to the distances in the universe, the journey to the moon pales into utter insignificance. It would take many millions of years for a spaceship to travel to some other stars, and yet there is a much simpler way, and I say to you absolutely definitely that astral travel could be that way. It has been done before. It is being done now by creatures, I say creatures because they are not in human form, who come from a completely different galaxy. They are here now at this moment, they have come by astral travel, and some of them occupy human bodies such as did the ancients of old. Humans, if they knew how, could send astral travelers anywhere transcending time and space. Astral travel can be as quick as thought. And if you don't know how quick thought is, I will tell you it would take a tenth of a second to go from here to Mars by astral travel. But in days to come explorers will be able to go to a world by astral travel, and there, by transmigration, they will be able to enter the body of a native of that world so that they may gain first-hand experience of what things are like. Now, this is not science fiction. It is absolutely true. If other people on other worlds can do it, then Earth people can do it also. But sadly I have to say that purely because of the false doubt which has been cast upon my word, this particular aspect has not been able to be taught to people. Unfortunately, when one takes over a body there is certain grave disabilities. Let me give you an illustration. I found soon after I had taken over a body that I could not write Sanskrit, I could not write Chinese. Oh yes, definitely I knew the language. I knew what I should be writing, but the body which I inhabited was not geared for making those squiggles which are Sanskrit or Chinese. It was only able to reproduce, say, letters such as English, French, German or Spanish. It is all to do with muscular control. You have had the same things even in the West when you find that a well-educated German with a better education than most English, let us say, still cannot pronounce English as the natives do. He cannot get his tongue around the sounds. So no matter how highly he is educated, he still cannot say the sounds correctly. It is said almost universally that you can always tell if a man is a native of a district or not by the manner in which he pronounces his words, that is, can he manage his vocal cords as the native would, or does habit bring in certain dissonances which the native lacks. In transferring to a different body one can do all the sounds, etc. because the body is producing sounds to which it is accustomed, English, French or Spanish, for example. But when it comes to writing, that is a different matter. Look at it this way, some people can draw or they can paint. So let us say that these people, the artists, have an ability to produce certain squiggles which have a definite meaning. Now, most people, even of the same race, cannot do that. And even with training, even with immense practice, unless a person is a born artist, the art forms are not considered acceptable. The same type of thing happens when an Eastern entity takes over a Western body. He can communicate in speech and he can know all that could be done in writing, but no longer can he write in that which was his original language, such as Sanskrit or Chinese or Japanese, because it takes years of practice, and his attempts are so fumbling, so crude, that the ideographs have no intelligible meaning. Another difficulty is that the entity is Eastern and the body or vehicle is Western. If you find that strange, let me say that if you were in England you would be driving a car with right-hand controls so that you may drive on the left-hand side of the road, but if you are in America you drive a car in which the steering wheel is on the left-hand side, and then you drive on the right-hand side of the road. Everyone knows that, eh? Well, you take some poor wretch of a driver who has been used to driving along the lanes of England, suddenly lift him out and put the poor soul slap into an American car and without any teaching at all let him loose on the American roads. The poor fellow wouldn't have much chance, would he? He wouldn't last long. All his built-in reflexes, which may have been trained for half a lifetime, would scream at having to be reversed suddenly, and in the emergency he would immediately drive to the wrong side of the road and cause the accident which he was trying to avoid. Do you follow that clearly? Believe me, I know this, it all happened to me. So transmigration is not for the uninitiated. I say in all sincerity, there could be a lot done in transmigration if people could get the right knowledge, and I am surprised that the Russians, who are so far ahead in so many things, have not yet hit upon the idea of transmigration. It is easy if you know how. It is easy if you can have suitable precautions. But if you try to teach these things, as I could, and you have a lot of mindless children, or press people, then the whole thing becomes negated almost before one can start. Another point which has to be considered is obtaining a suitable vehicle or body, because you cannot just jump into any body and take over like a bandit entering a car stopped at a traffic light. Oh no, it is much harder than that. You have to find a body which is harmonious to your own, which has a harmonic somewhere, and it doesn't mean to say that the owner of the body has to be good or bad, that has nothing to do with it at all, it is to do with the vibrational frequency of that body. If you are interested in radio, you will know that you can have, let us say, a super heterodyne receiver which has three tuning condensers. Now if the set is working properly you get one station clearly, but as you get on harmonics you actually pick up the same signal on different wavelengths or different frequencies, it is all the same thing. In a frequency one just counts the number of times the wave changes from positive to negative, etc. But when you take a wavelength you just measure the distance between adjacent wave crests. It is the same as calling a rose by another name, but what I am trying to tell you is it possible, but it is going to be an everyday thing in the distant future here on Earth. But back to Thames Ditton. It was quite a nice little place, one of the suburbias of the great city of London. I believe it is also called one of the dormitories of London. There were a number of trees in the place, and every morning one could see businessmen scurrying away to Thames Ditton station, where they would get a train taking them to Wimbledon and other parts of London so they could do their daily work. Many of the men were from the City of London, stockbrokers, insurance men, bankers, and all the rest of it. Where I lived was right opposite the Cottage Hospital. Much further on to the right one came to a sort of sports ground, and adjacent to the sports ground was a big building called the Milk Marketing Board. Thames Ditton was better class, and some of the voices I could hear through my open window were too much better class, because I found some of the heavily accented voices difficult indeed to understand. But speech was not easy for me. I had to think before I could utter a sound, and then I had to visualize the shape of the sound I was trying to say. Speech to most people comes naturally. You can babble forth without any difficulty, without any great thought, but not when you are an Easterner who has taken over a Western body. Even to this day I have to think what I am going to say, and that makes my speech appear somewhat slow and at times hesitant. If one takes over a body, for the first year or two the body is basically the body of the host, that is, it was taken over. But in the course of time the body frequency changes and eventually it becomes of the same frequency as one's original body, and one's original scars appear. It is, As I told you before, like electroplating or like electrotyping, because molecule changes from molecule. This should not be too difficult to believe, because if you get a cut and the cut heals, then you've got replacement molecules, haven't you? They are not the same molecules that were cut, but new cells that were grown to replace the cut ones. It is something like that in transmigration. The body ceases to be the alien body taken over. Instead, molecule by molecule, it becomes one's own body, the body which one has grown. Just one last piece of information about transmigration. It makes one different. It gives associates a peculiar feeling to be close to one, and if a transmigrated person touches another person unexpectedly, that other person may squeak with shock and say, "Oh, now you've given me goose pimples." So if you want to practice transmigration, you will have to consider the disadvantages as well as the advantages. You know how strange dogs sniff around each other, stiff-legged, waiting for the first move by the other? Well, that is how I have found people in the Western world toward me. They do not understand me, they don't know what it is all about, they feel that there is something different and they do not know what it is, so often they will have uncertainty about me. They do not know if they like me or if they thoroughly dislike me, and it really does make difficulties, difficulties which are made manifest in the way that policemen are always suspicious of me, customs officials are always ready to believe the worst, and immigration officers always want to inquire further as to why, how, and when, etc., etc. It makes one, in effect, unacceptable to the local natives. But we must get on to the next book. But before we do, here is a final word in case you find it difficult to understand that which I have written about Easterners who have transmigrated being able to write their own language. If you are right-handed, write this paragraph with your right hand, then try to do the same thing with your left. So ends the third book, The Book of Changes. Book 4 as it is now. Chapter 10, Sunlight glanced off the placid river sailing so majestically by, sweeping along down to the sea like the Akashic record sweeping along down to the sea of universal knowledge. But here this river was engaging my attention. I looked through half-closed eyes at all the little sparklets, at the dappled surface as occasionally a leaf went floating by. There was a sudden rustle and flutter, and three water birds alighted with great splashing on the surface of the water. For some moments they splashed around, throwing water over themselves, digging beneath their wings and generally having a good avian time. Then, as if at a sudden signal, they spread their wings, paddled their feet and took off in formation, leaving three increasing circles of ripples behind them. Sunlight through the leaves of the trees put contrasting spots of light and shadow on the water's edge before me. The sun was warm. I lay back and became aware of a buzzing noise. Slowly I opened my eyes, and there right in front of my nose was a bee looking at me with great interest. Then, as if deciding that I could not be a suitable source of nectar, or whatever it is that bees seek, it buzzed the louder and veered off to some flower sheltering in the shade of a tree. I could hear it droning away there as it busily probed into the flower, and then it came out backwards and I saw that its legs and body were covered in yellow pollen. It was pleasant here, reclining beneath the trees by the side of the River Thames at Thames Ditton, facing the great palace of Hampton Court. My attention wandered and I suppose I dozed. Whatever it was, I suddenly became aware of a noise in the distance. I had visions of the royal barge coming down from the Tower of London and carrying Queen Elizabeth I with her then favorite boyfriend and the retinue of servants which seemed inevitable in royal circles. There was music aboard the royal barge, and it seemed incongruous to me to have such music when coming up the Thames, but I could hear the splashing of oars, and the creaking of rowlocks. There was much giggling, and I thought to myself in my half-sleep state that surely people in early Elizabethan days did not behave as modern teenagers so. I opened my eyes, and there just coming around the bend was a large bunt filled with teenagers and with a gramophone aboard as well as a radio. Both were blaring out different tunes. They rode along chattering away, everyone seemed to be talking on a different subject, no one was taking any notice of anyone else. They went along past Hampton Court and disappeared from my sight, and for a time again all was peace. I thought again of the great Queen Elizabeth and of her journeys from the Tower of London to Hampton Court. Nearly opposite to where I lay on the bank was the site where they used to have a landing jetty. The rowers used to come close and then ropes would be thrown and the barge pulled in gently so as not to upset the Queen's balance because she was not a very good sailor, not even on the Thames. Hampton Court itself was a place that I found fascinating. I visited it often, and even under some unusual conditions, and I could see clearly that the place was indeed haunted with the spirits of those whose bodies had so long ago departed. But there was much talking going on behind me, and I turned round and saw four people there. "Oh my goodness," said a woman, "you are so still you haven't moved for the last 10 minutes that we thought you were dead." With that they moved on, talking and talking and talking. The world, I thought, had too much noise, everyone had too much talk and too little to say. With that thought in mind I glanced about me. There were a few boats on the River Thames in front of me. Just down to the left of me was an old man who looked as if he might have been Father Time himself. He was stuck there like an old tree trunk. He had a pipe in his mouth and a faint haze of smoke was coming from it. Tied to a stick in front of him he had a fishing rod, the float of which red and white bobbed about just in front of me. I watched him for a short time, he didn't move either, and I wondered what people really saw in fishing. I came to the conclusion that it was just an excuse on the part of some elderly people so that they could keep still and meditate, think of the past, and wonder what the future held for them. The future? I looked at my watch in alarm, and then hurried to get to my feet and mount the old bicycle which had been lying beside me on the bank. With more haste than usual I pedalled off down the road and around to the right, and so on the way to Westmalsea where the unemployment exchange was. But no, there was no employment for me, no offer of a job. It seemed there were too many people and too few jobs, and as one man told me so bluntly, "Well mate, you left your job and you didn't have to, so as you left it and you didn't have to, you don't get paid nothing, see? So it stands to reason that the government ain't going to pay a fellow what left his job because he had a job before he left it, so you won't get no dole, and so long as you don't get no dole this here exchange won't get you no job. The exchange keeps its jobs for those who've got dole because if they get the fellow a job, they don't have to pay him dole and so their statistics look better. I tried commercial employment agencies, those places where you go and pay money, and where in theory they find you a job. My own experience may have been particularly unfortunate, but in spite of trying quite a number none of them ever offered me a job. I managed to get just odd things to do around Thames Ditton and the district. I was able to do certain medical work which the orthodox physician could not do or would not do and I thought well, I am a fully qualified medical man and I've got the papers to prove it so why don't I try to get registered in England? Sometime later I approached the General Medical Council unofficially. Actually I went to their place and told them all about it. They told me that yes, I had all the qualifications but unfortunately Dunking was now in the hands of the communists and, they said, I just could not expect my qualifications to be recognized as they were obtained in a communist country. I produced my papers, and shoved it straight under the secretary's nose. I said, look. When these papers were prepared, China was not a communist country, it was an ally of England, France, the USA, and many other countries. I fought for peace just the same as people in England fought for peace, and just because I was in a different country does not mean to say that I haven't got feelings the same as you have. He hummed and hawed and grunted around, and then he said, come back in a month's time. We'll see what can be arranged. Yes, yes. I quite agree, your qualifications are such that they should be recognized. The only thing impeding such recognition is that Chongqing is now a city in a communist country. So I left his office and went to the Huntrian Museum to look at all the specimens in bottles, and I thought then how amazing it was that humans everywhere were humans everywhere, they all functioned in roughly the same way and yet if a person was trained in one country he was not considered qualified to treat people in a different country. It was all beyond me. But jobs were difficult indeed to obtain, and the cost of living at Thames Ditton was quite excessive. I found that as a married man, who in theory I was, expenses were far, far more than when I had to manage alone. At this stage of the book, perhaps I might take a moment to answer some of those people who write to me horribly offensively asking why should I, a Lama of Tibet, live with a woman, have a wife? Well, all you ladies who write so offensively, let me tell you this, I am still a monk, I still live as a monk, and possibly some of you ladies have indeed heard of celibate bachelors who have a landlady or a sister with whom they live without necessarily thinking of that. So ladies, the answer is no, I don't. But the time had come to leave Thames Ditton, and we moved nearer into London because by my own efforts I had made a job available for myself. I came to the conclusion that as the body that I now occupied was living overtime, there were no opportunities for it. The former occupant of the body, I saw by the Akashic record, really and truly had been going to commit suicide, and that would have completed all the opportunities which his vehicle, his body, would have had. Thus, no matter how hard I tried, I could never take a job which another person could do. The only employment that I could take would be that which I generated for myself. Now, I don't propose to say what employment that was, nor where I did it, because it is nothing to do with this story, but it proved to be adequate to supply our immediate wants and to keep us going. But I must tell you one thing which irritated me immensely. Again, it was connected with my old enemies, the police. I was driving through South Kensington with an anatomical figure in the back of a car. It was one of those figures which appear in dress shops or which are sometimes provided for the training of surgical fitters. This figure was in the back of the car, and when I had started out it had been covered up with cloth, but I drove with the window open and I suppose the draft had blown part of the cloth off the figure. I was driving along quite peacefully thinking of what I was going to do next when suddenly there was a loud blare beside me, which nearly made me jump through the roof. I looked in the mirror and I found two figures gesticulating at me, pointing me to pull into the side of the road. There were a lot of cars parked at the side of the road, so I drove in a little to try to find a place where I could stop. The next thing was, this police car, for such it was, tried to ram me, thinking, they said, that I was attempting to escape at 15 miles an hour in traffic. Well, I stopped just where I was, holding up the traffic, and I couldn't care less about how crossed the people in the other cars were, so I just stopped there. The police motioned for me to get out and come to them, but I thought, no, they want to see me, I don't want to see them, so I just sat. Eventually one policeman got out with his truncheon already in his hand. He looked as if he was going to face a firing squad or something, he really did look frightened. Slowly he came up to my side of the car, walking more or less sideways, presumably to make less of a target in case I started shooting. Then he looked into the back of the car and turned a bright red. "Well, officer, what is it? What am I supposed to have done?" I asked him. The policeman looked at me and he really did look silly. He looked absolutely sheepish. "I'm sorry, sir," he said, "but we were told that a man was driving around and a naked woman's legs were showing through the back window." I reached into the back and pulled the cloth right off the figure, and then I said, "Well, officer, show me any sign of life in this model. Show me how she has been killed. Take a good look at her." And then I covered the figure more carefully. The policeman went back to his car and all the cars behind us were hooting away as if they were trying to fill a concert hall or something. Feeling thoroughly bad-tempered, I drove off. There was another occasion with the police which may raise a smile. I had an office in London and it was very near an underground tube station. My wife often used to come and visit me round about lunchtime, and when she was leaving I used to look out of the window just to see that she safely crossed that busy London street. One day I was just getting ready to finish up and go home when there was a loud official knock at the door. I got up and went to the door and there were two very large policemen. One said, "We want to know what you are doing here." I turned and let them come into my office. He looked about with interest and his associate got ready to act as witness. Everywhere the chief policeman looked, his associate looked also. I invited them to be seated, but no, they would not be seated. They were there on official business, they told me. They said they thought I was engaged in some illicit activity and that I was giving signals to some gang. This really shocked me, In fact, I was almost stunned with amazement, and I just could not understand what they were talking about. "Whatever do you mean?" I exclaimed. The chief policeman said, "Well, it has been reported to us that you make strange signals at about midday, and we have kept watch and we have seen those strange signals." "To whom are you signaling?" Then it dawned on me and I started to laugh. I said, "Oh good God, whatever is the world coming to? I am merely waving to my wife when I watch to see that she crosses the road safely and enters the tube station." He said in reply, "That cannot be so. You cannot see the station from here." Without another word I got up from my chair, opened the window which was just to my right, and said, "Look and see for you." They looked at each other and then together they went to the window and looked out. Sure enough, just as I said, there was the underground station opposite. They both changed color a bit, and I said to make them change color a bit more, "Oh yes, I've seen you two fellows, you were in that block of flats opposite, I saw you trying to hide behind the curtains. I wondered what you were up to." The chief policeman then said, "You occupy the floor beneath this office. We have information that you are engaged in sexual activities in that flat below." I had had enough of this, and I said, "All right, come downstairs with me and see all the naked females for yourself." They were not at all happy with my attitude and they wondered what they had done wrong. Together we went down a flight of stairs and I unlocked a big showroom, the windows of which were heavily curtained with expensive lace net. Above the curtained windows there were small ventilators about a foot square which, of course, were not curtained. I went to one lay figure and picked it up, and said, "Look, if a person is carrying this around, putting it from here to here." I demonstrated a prying nosy parka of an old woman who lives in that flat opposite might think it is a nude body. I rapped on the figures and said, "All right, take a look at them, do they look obscene to you?" The policeman changed their tune completely, and the senior one said, "Well, I am sorry you have been troubled, sir, I really am most sorry, but we received a complaint from the sister of a very senior police officer saying that strange things are happening here. We are quite satisfied with what we have seen. You will not be troubled again." Well, I was. I had to go to my office one evening at about 7 o'clock and I unlocked the doors and went in, as I had a perfect right to do. I did the bit of work that I had to do, and then left. As I locked the door behind me, two policemen seized me quite roughly and tried to hustle me to a police car. But I knew my rights and I asked for an immediate explanation. They told me that it had been reported, yes, it was the same woman, that a sinister looking man, that's me, had been seen to break into the building, so they were waiting for me. They would not believe that I had a right to be there, so I unlocked the office again and we went in, and I had actually to call the estate agent who had rented me the place, and he identified me by my voice. Once again the police looked silly and departed without a word. Soon after that I decided that there was no point in staying in such an office where it was obvious that the old biddy opposite had nothing better to do with her time than imagine that she was a policewoman reporting all manner of imaginary criminal offences. So I left that office and went elsewhere. Again, I did certain psychological work among people who could get no assistance from orthodox medicine and I did quite well, I really did. I cured a number of people, but then one day there was a man who tried to blackmail me. So I learned that unless one was actually registered, one was too much at the mercy of people who would gladly get all the assistance they could and then try to blackmail one. But the blackmailer, well, he didn't get his way after all. Just at this time a young lady came into our life of her own accord, of her own free will. We regarded her as a daughter and still do, and she is still with us. But her destiny, she felt, was such that she had to live with us, and that she did. Later the press was to make much of this, trying to say that it was a case of the eternal triangle. Nothing could have been firmer than the truth. We were standing on the square instead of in the eternal triangle. At about this time I was introduced to an author's agent. I thought I was going to get a job with him reading and commenting upon authors' type scripts, but no. He knew a bit of my story and very, very much against my own will I allowed myself to be persuaded into writing a book. One cannot be too particular when starvation is just around the corner, you know, and starvation wasn't just around the corner, it was knocking hard on the door. So I wrote a book, and then certain authors who were jealous at my knowledge of Tibet tried to trace me up.